committed. I put a ring on it, as the song goes. I'm going to try and start with a stool. I'm hyped about some of these questions, so I might end up pacing and yelling, so I do apologize. Jason, awesome. Thank you for recording, buddy. So I'm in sound ministry, and I never record any of our sessions, and like our whole staff knows it. And so everybody comes up behind me and makes sure that I did everything. So we got a lot of great questions, a lot of great questions, some personal ones, some deep theological ones. So we're obviously, I think we got like 23. 20 of them are from the last 45 minutes, but they were really good. They were really good. So we're going to try and go over a couple of these. I absolutely love these opportunities because it, I think just even as a leadership team, and we've done this in the past where we all took like a group of questions and took the time to kind of research it, really reflect on our hearts and kind of respond. It always puts you on the spot for what you really know, right? You know, and some questions are rarely as simple because even the way a question is innately developed can have a lot of preconceived notions in the statement. Kind of like, why are you such a jerk? I could answer that, you know, like I could, but it already predisposed my response to try and disprove that I am a jerk, that I'm not a jerk, though I am, in answering that particular question. But I did forget to announce two things, one that I'm really excited about. How many of you guys have heard me speak about a guy that we are connected with in the UK? His name is John. I think we mentioned in the past from up here. I know. I talked to him this week, so he heard last week's message, and I know I mentioned it then. John is a guy that my wife, Justin, Jason, and I met about 6 months or so, kind of built a relationship with him. He got to hang out with us during our time in Salt Lake City, and, I mean, he was just blown away by just some of the street ministry opportunities that we were involved with, we were there. And so in going back, just got really fired up. And over the last several months, us and a couple other people that he's connected with have just really been supporting him, offering him resources, just backing him up. And John's planning a church. February 23rd, he planted a church. And to me, I took a step back and was blown away by that because I said February 23rd, didn't I? It will be planted on March 23rd, not February 23rd. That would put us in the past. You were correct. Sorry. We're still in January. Wait, no. Yes, February 23rd. We are in January. I thought we were in February. Sorry about that. But and I'm so proud of this guy because to me that like that's the whole point of not just evangelism, but discipleship. The unlocking of what is in someone's heart and what God designed them and called them to. And I think we sort of start at the, oh, it's great to meet you, you know, good job being a Christian, you know, and you kind of move on. Then the relationship building that releases someone to do something that, you know, they, you know, no one else but them has been designed to do in their particular area or region of or area of expertise or region that they find themselves in. I'm so proud of John because, I mean, when we met that guy, we knew, like, this guy's got it. But you can tell the confidence wasn't there. And in just spending time with this guy and just supporting him and praying for him, and he added a couple of you guys on Facebook, and you guys just praying for him, you know, gave him the courage and the opportunity that the doors had opened up for the guy to plant a church in the UK. And I'm just blown away by that. We got to influence a church plant and get it off the ground and can help him in that process in a time where, you know, to me, I'm like, that's why Paul wrote those Pauline letters, you know? He was constantly writing to these church plants and supporting, you know, from afar, only we've got Facebook, Skype, and a couple of things that make things a little easier. So I just kind of want to let you guys know what was going on there. Continue to pray for John. Continue to reach out to him. Continue to love on the guy. I think it's an amazing opportunity just to continue to influence the church in another country, in another hemisphere. Like, that is, like, beyond that. So, I don't even know where we are. Yeah. Close to another hemisphere. Is that a little bit more accurate? Yeah. Yeah. Living in the Western world. Different continent. Let's go with that one. Continent, different country. Different zip code. We're really safe there. We're really safe there. From a different, we can influence the church in Vieira, who's outside of our zip code. So the first question is, how do you feel about how Christianity and politics merge, intersect, and collide? Wow. So this is going to, I'm going to make enemies tonight. I know I am. Absolutely. I know that I am. Interestingly enough, this very question was asked of a preacher and teacher, a Greg Boyd. I've gotten the opportunity to go through a lot of his sermons. And he was asked the very same question, and he did an entire sermon. First time he did the sermon, his church of several thousand people lost 1,000 people overnight. Overnight, because of his approach to this question. And I thought, and quite frankly, I thought he was not only fair, I thought he was really generous in his response. So I could only imagine what tonight's going to feel like. I think, yeah. So thank all 50 of you for showing up tonight. Feel free to leave something in the offering box and have a good life. No, I think what's difficult about and for starters, guys, I was born here. I love this country, America, right with you guys. I celebrate July 4th too. I'm from New England. The Minutemen, come on, you know, the circuit riders. It was all about. That's all I knew as a child. I was indoctrinated into what I like to call American theology. I think what happens in our country, because Christianity was such an incredible influence in the early stages of our development and still continues to be in some aspects of our country, we have this tendency to believe that that mixture is untainted from our American perspective. It, you know, we hear the term separation of church and state, which is, as many of you learned people here tonight know, that that was a private conversation Thomas Jefferson had with someone else in which he was concerned about the corruption of government to the church and was concerned about that, so talking about separation in that regard. We have a tendency to be fearful of the other end of it, the church affecting the government. But if you look at our version of Christianity, and I do say version, we have a very Western theological approach to our faith. We tend to believe that it's pure because we were founded on the Bible and it continues to be our influence. So therefore, we have the purest form of Christianity. We have the greatest understanding because we have unlimited resources, unlimited access to information, research. So the way we view Christianity is the right way. Yet in that belief, we begin to really bring about a lot of nationalism into our faith and adopt a lot of really bizarre beliefs that when you visited another country, you realize that those things do not work in that context at all. Those things, suddenly a lot of what we found foundational to our faith, we begin to realize that the only reason it ever became foundational is because from a nationalistic standpoint, it was foundational to our country, to our way, our culture, our form of living. As a nation, we love violence. We love our freedom. We love weapons. Come on, we live in the South. You know, we don't own one gun. We own like 15. It's not enough to own one gun. We have a tank. We've got, you know, attack dogs. We're like, you know, we are better armed than like North Korea. You know what I mean? And the guys, and you would think like we must have some serious post-traumatic stress from the Civil War. I have no idea. But like everything we have is just like this holding our own. And in a sense, it's developed a very what we define as patriotism that can often be an ugly form of nationalism. And I think the sad reality is it begins to approach our view of Christianity and what the Bible says about certain things. So just to kind of give you a little perspective on what we're talking about, the way we celebrate leadership in our culture, even as a government within politics, right? You've got these politicians, you know, conservative liberals. Usually we've got a two-party system thing going. Everything's two-party. Everything's two extremes. And, the conservatives will appeal to the Christians, right? And they'll gravitate to a couple ideologies and kind of grab those things. And then liberals also appeal to Christians by gravitating to a couple of things, you know. And then one side will hold three foundational pillars to our faith. The other side holds three other foundational pillars to our faith. And we're put in the position to choose which one we want to go for. What will we support? What will we believe? And a lot of times we fail to recognize that sometimes we buy into certain things that we have convinced ourselves are where Jesus would stand and where his opinion would be on the way things are handled. And one of the things that I love to look at, and which is why I find people like Martin Luther King being so foundational to the way I would think government and leadership should stand. In Luke 22, verse 24 through 30, Jesus is talking to his disciples, and he says, and Luke says, a dispute also arose among them as to which of them was considered to be greatest. And Jesus said to them, the kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who exercise authority over them call themselves benefactors. But you are not to be like that. Instead, the greatest among you should be like the youngest, and the one who rules like the one who serves. For who is greater, the one who is at the table or the one who serves? Is it not the one who is at the table? But I am among you as the one who serves. You are those who have stood by me in my trials, and I confer on you a kingdom, just as my Father conferred one on me, so that you may eat and drink at my table in the kingdom and sit on the thrones and judging the 12 tribes of Israel. In another gospel, he says, you are to be like the youngest among you. And in Jewish culture, the youngest always got the crap work. The oldest was the one that the family was proud of. He was the benefactor. He inherited everything. He was the one that people looked up to. He was the leader. He was the guy who bared the responsibility. He was the ideal form of leadership and the way something should be ran, the way character should be exemplified. But Jesus goes, no, be like the younger. I want you to be like the exact opposite. I want you to be like the one who gets the crap job, the one who serves without complaining, the one who's not going to benefit from the situation, the one who seeks the path of humility. And he continues to say, as I serve you, not coming to live like the Gentiles, to not live like the world system operates, where the world system says the greatest form of influence is a top-down form of service, where I, the person of highest authority, will delegate the things the way things should be done. And he says, no, leadership starts at the bottom. It comes from a path of humility. It comes from a path of service. The reason I say that I celebrate a person like Martin Luther King, because he refused to allow violence to taint his ministry and his response to the wrong of the world. His view was, I will not overcome evil by responding the same way. I would prefer you to attack me, belittle me, and through my service and through my humility, expose the ugliness that exists, that humility would one day be celebrated and that righteousness might be restored. In a culture that says, no, attack, fight. Be on the offense. In a culture that often says, our approach is often, not a counter-strike when you strike, a preemptive strike. I'll punch you first so you don't hit me. Wow. Like, that's how we celebrate, leadership. That's how we run government, I'm going to put my hands in your pot first before, so you don't ever come to mine. And it very rarely exemplifies leadership. So I think a lot of times Christian true kingdom theology can be very anti-American in a lot of ways because it is a world system. It's a world system. And yes, we are called to influence the world around us, and we're called to influence government, but American government and Christianity is not synonymous. And to walk in such a way that we can acknowledge and recognize what someone says and recognizing the ugliness of our culture as not being anti-patriotic or un-American. The coined phrase, if you don't like my country, get out. That's not humility. Like, that's not, the way we approach often the way of the world from a fatalistic standpoint, well, that's just the way it is. That's just the way government is. Well, that's just the way people lead. To me, politics and Christianity touch and certainly we're called to influence our government, but at the same time, I see Jesus walking a line where people constantly try to pull him towards where you pay taxes to Caesar, supporting the government system that rules over us and reigns over our people, supporting the system that oppresses the very people you're supposed to be from. Or do you stand with us, the oppressed, the ones that are beaten down, the ones that are spit on, the ones that are oppressed by those people? Which one? Will you financially support what those guys are doing? Or will you stand with us? A pull between two conflicts. Will you serve the way the world works? And what's the path that he paves? He looks at the image, making a point, the image of Caesar. He says, the image of the world at that time, the known commerce. And he says, this is how these guys work. Give to them what belongs to them, but you give to God what belongs to God. We don't operate like this. We're beyond this. We're better than this. We think differently. We don't buy into this stuff. Truthfully, at the highest form of government, we have espionage. We have, all those things. And again, I'm not, go ahead and put me on the hit list of like the NSA or whatever, but I think we all recognize, for the sake of national security, we see all those movies where the blurred lines of righteousness and unrighteousness, is shown, and sort of we have this like, well, for the greater good of country, we're willing to kind of cross those boundaries versus recognizing that Jesus paved a path that said truth, absolute truth, not hidden truth, absolute truth should be celebrated. And that would restore, that will protect, that will bring about the faith you guys want to have, that will bring about the government you want to live in. Serving the homeless, serving the lost, serving the outsider. Jesus represented, if you read, I think it's Matthew 16, where it talks about Jesus responding to the centurion and Jesus healing the leper, two of the most fantastic things I feel about the set of those parables or Jesus' response in those ministries is that he's ministering to a national outsider, a leper who was not allowed to operate within society, someone that was kicked out by his own people. He is serving and touching. That's anti-religion. That's anti the way we run things here. And then who does he serve? The centurion. You're serving Al-Qaeda, dude. You seriously just healed the servant of one of the leaders of Al-Qaeda. Are you kidding me? He literally walked those lines of social service and showed them, my Father's kingdom does not lay those lines of us and them, enemy and us, the outsider. And we don't walk that way. And I think a lot of times in our form of patriotism, we tend to buy into certain things or certain ideologies that's very anti-kingdom, that's very anti the way Jesus would serve. And our lens, our approach to those things can be very ugly. It already starts off like a silly question like, why are you such a jerk? Well, you already think I'm a jerk. how can I respond to it? So we have this sort of like, I think, an awful approach. I think the best way to influence government is through prayer. I think the best way to influence government is to serve the poor, is to serve the lost. I think the best way to serve is to change the way leadership is ran. I think I'm not nothing against voting, but I'm not entirely sure that the best system to change our government is going to be casting a vote when we have an entire New Testament that says otherwise. It's in praying for your leaders. It's in serving the lost. It's in serving the enemy. It's in developing a culture from the bottom up, not from the top down. And so for me, again, I will argue politics and, kind of get involved in some of that stuff. But at the end of the day, I think those things do touch, but our influence are more within the kingdom realm that God has given us. I think it has more to do, the best picture I would use would be almost the way you would see a diplomat visit another country. I don't really operate by your system. I represent mine. And I'm here to influence those things and offer those tools, but I'm not buying into what you guys do over here. Make sense? I'm sure I'll get a lot of angry emails for that one. What are your thoughts on evangelism, street evangelism? What comes to your mind when you think of this? Give an example of what you would say to someone you didn't know. For me, street evangelism, going back to Jesus, I will always say as just a staple rule, if our approach to whatever we do was to go back to the gospel and look at the very revolutionary that paved the way and begin to imitate those things, we would be safe in our responses. I think for me, the greatest reality of evangelism is the opportunity to reinstate dignity in an individual that has been made in God's image. It's our opportunity to unlock a prophetic reality of who they are that they themselves don't see. to not treat them the way they view themselves and the world sees them, but to treat them the way God would view them and the way God would treat them. I see the way Jesus, and with few exceptions, I see the way Jesus dealt with people as always a reinstituting of the truth of who they were. Drawing fishermen, drawing the lost, drawing women into a ministry during a time when they would be looked down on, where it's a reinstituting of calling, of a rightful place. Jesus's work on earth was not just reflective on, hey, I'm here to die for you and clock out. No. I'm here to live among you, suffer with you, smell like you, be associated with you, and to show you what it means to be, to acknowledge, to instill love in people's hearts. And then when I die and am resurrected, I'm going to be elevated at my Father's right hand and draw you to that same place. And to me, as ambassadors, as being called to the, as Paul defines it, the ministry of reconciliation, our job is to draw people in to reconcile who they are with God and who he's made them to be. So how does that look in a practical sense? I don't stand in a street corner and go, you're going to hell. Cool, thanks. Like I didn't know that. You know, your life is full of sin. Right, I expected that. What they don't expect is love in your eyes, recognition of who you are, drawing out that identity so that it's at the forefront of who they are, and letting the gospel of truth and love be a call them to transformation and change. The example that I use is, I did not meet my wife and fall in love with her and get her to marry me by telling her how awful she is. Pretty messed up, right? Well, if you want to marry me, you got to get organized because this is out of control. Clean that purse, please. You know, you're going to have to clean up your clothes, that whole one time a month thing. I do not want to see that equipment around my house. You would not approach someone that's like, well, guess who I'm not going to be with? It came out of a wooing, an expression of my love and my affection for her that drew her to a place where she wanted a relationship. And in marriage, it's our role with one another to do that very same thing. It's a calling to who you already are. And for me, street evangelism would look like, and we've done this before, walking around in downtown Melbourne to homeless people and telling them that God loves them and spending time with them. I'm not just going to say some words to you. I'm actually going to chill with you. Can I buy you something to eat? How's life? How are you doing? I've got nothing to gain from this. I'm here to treat you like a person in a society that doesn't. I'm not here to just facilitate a need, here's $5. I'm sitting here to speak and declare love through my actions where we sit and hang out and spend time together. I've seen more lives transformed and sustained in Christianity by an institution of respect and mutual affection for someone where you genuinely care than in fear-mongering. You're going to hell. You're a sinner. There's something wrong with you. Now get saved so you can be better. Bye. What does that produce? Well, now I think I'm all this junk that you said about me, only now I'm a Christian. How could he love me if I'm this bad? Versus the reality of like, be transformed by love, because it's the kindness of God that leads to repentance. It's his heart drawing you. So I think living in a post-evangelical society, the idea is less from a theological standpoint of a breakdown of someone's character, of defaming them of who they are, and more about a reinstitution of dignity and who God's called them to be. And I think deep down inside, you recognize that. I don't care if you're a Christian or not. There is a longing to be acknowledged for who you are, even if you don't get it. I think every one of us who has spent time where before you were a Christian can look at a time where you just wished someone could say that, like draw that out of you. I know I was made in someone's image. I know that I'm not utterly lost. There's got to be something. And when people have put their finger on that and said, nah, dude, like, you're right. There is goodness in you. You are reflective of who your Father has made you to be. I think he calls us his Father, because regardless of the actions that my son, my future son, if I have a son, but my daughters will ever do, they're still my kid. And when we discipline and raise them, it's about a reinstitution of identity. We don't sit there and go, you're breaking the rules. We say things like, Adeline, princesses don't eat from the floor. They don't. And they're like, and you're a princess, right? And she's like, yeah, they don't eat from the floor? No, I'm like, no, no. All those Disney movies, princesses do not eat from the floor. story, princesses don't punch the cat in the face. Like, that's not, it's not a thing princesses do. They you know, rule well, right? You see them talking to the animals and doing all those things, and she lets go of the cat, you know? And it's a reinstitution of identity, because I want them to recognize, I am a princess. I don't have to understand some deep theological idea. I am a princess, and I want to act like one, and I want to live like one, because that is a greater calling than, yeah. So, beat that one to death. question three. What would you say is the mission of the church? What is our charter? Our church? The church? I won't get into some of the atonement belief that I stand on. One of the questions that was submitted was, would you explain crisis victor versus penal substitution? And so I guess it's gotten around in our church that that's been topics of discussion. And someone put up a Facebook meme. I think it was you. Ain't nobody got time for that. Like, what's the response? And I remember reading that. I'm like, wow, that would be a whole service, like, to answer that question. What was that? It's been a quarter. Yeah. Yeah. And I say that to say that there are multiple forms or multiple motifs or approaches to why Jesus died for us. And I, who lean towards one of the sides that's referred to as crisis victor, it was the original view of the church for the first 1,100 years that addresses more of God reconciling creation as a whole with mankind as a part of that to himself, and reinstating the authority back to man that Adam and Eve operated under. So to me, I believe that Jesus is calling to his church, to his bride, is certainly to operate in a spotless fashion, but I think spotless meaning more reflective of who he is. And I think that our main mission is to draw back, draw the world back into a place where God's kingdom, his life, flowed freely in the body, in our world, where I think that's largely the difference between this idea that Christianity somehow offers a different view of life. Right, that's sort of taught as a philosophy. It's a different approach to life. But by definition, sin is defined as the things that cause death in people. And the things that we're called to are the things that produce life. Cancer is bad. Medicine is good, right? You don't have to be a theology major to understand that. Christianity is the explanation of what those things are. This causes death. This causes life, no matter what religion, no matter gravity is gravity, up is up, down is down. And Christianity defines the reality of the path of Jesus wasn't a way, it was the way, because it produced life as God created life to function as. And we kind of try to do this like matrix thing where we want to break the system, you know, like, but it doesn't function that way. It wasn't created that way. We're not designed to function that way. So when we see sin and it produces death, it's because innately sin cannot produce goodness. And as a church, it's the call of the body to draw the world into that place of life. The Garden of Eden was supposed to be this place of life. It was supposed to be, when we think about that, whether we read about it in poetry, in literature, whatever, it's always painted as this like magical place that was amazing and like bacon all the time and unicorns and rainbows. And you're just like, oh my God, like it's like Disney, only not expensive, you know, at all, or creepy. But I think the reality is that the mission of the church is to call people to life, to call people to identity, to call people to identify themselves as a kingdom. I think if I could use a modern example, I think it has a lot to do with, it's like the movie Tangled. How many of you guys saw the movie Tangled? Everybody saw that. Come on. Don't lie. Never seen it? All right. In the movie Tangled, it is the story of Rapunzel, right, who is kidnapped as a baby, and she has this magical hair that when she sings, it heals people, right? And so she's kidnapped because this evil woman wants to remain young forever. And so one day someone stumbles upon her. She's trying to escape from the evil woman, and they discover that she is the princess to this kingdom, and she hasn't been there since she was a baby, so she doesn't know this about herself. And so she has these healing properties that anyone who is hurt, who is sick, she is able to heal, and she is being reinstated in her identity as a princess to this kingdom. Anybody see it? Like, do I have to paint it more? Do we get it? I think our role a lot of times, Disney grasps at that. The reigning kingdom of benevolence and goodness of our Father and the reinstitution of his sons and daughters. And I think we as a people have that. And a lot of times it's defined as sloppy grace, but I don't think it is sloppy grace because it doesn't say that sin isn't sin at all. It's that it focuses on the fact that if you see God in his goodness and you hear him call you, you will respond. You will recognize because you were designed to hold his image. Does that make sense? What time is it? Yeah. Everybody good to stay until 9? Children's ministry says no. My phone has been like vibrating with more and more questions. I'm not looking at it. I'm sorry. it's still projected. That's why. I'm like, is it still back there? You're welcome. Yeah. Okay. When you feel like God doesn't hear you, what is the problem? When you feel like God doesn't hear you, what is the problem? Is God listening? Is it what you're saying? What is the issue? There was a very similar question that we were asked. So obviously this is important. There are two repeating questions. Is one about the walking dead, and then there's this one. That every time we do a Q&A, the one about the walking dead is, why aren't there zombie babies in the walking dead? Is it the rapture that caused the zombie babies to disappear? Thank you, Jesse Wallace. We will save that for a whole church service in which we will break down after the rapture. That's messed up. All right. The last time this question was asked was, the question was formulated as, I am struggling in my prayer life and I'm having a hard time hearing from God, and I'm how can I work on that? And I offered, I use the term having five filters that will help you kind of understand hearing the voice of God. I think that's the biggest struggle. Of course, God hears you, whether he wants you or not, but no, he's just that good. No, of course he hears you. And I think a lot of times it's our sort of distortion of our own lives that kind of caused that. Is he responding? Does he listen? And the first filter that I say is you got to believe that God loves you. Everything that we approach in our faith is the foundational truth is that he loves you. So he does. He loves you, so he does. He loves you. Of course he's going to respond. He loves you. You know, sometimes you say, it's your dad. They're not going to kill you. You know, my dad's going to kill me. I stole the car, you know. He won't kill you because he's your dad. But, you know, it's that reality that he's our father. He loves us. And if we don't believe that he loves us, then we won't believe that he'll respond to us. Why would he listen to me? Does he even care? Does he even listen? Does he care about the situation, or is it just me? It deflates all of those things. Kind of like the Patriots footballs were deflated in the last game. But I had to make a reference to that. Someone doesn't like football in the back. But it's, to me, it's the reality of recognizing that God loves you. One of the books that I found that absolutely transformed my life, and I always want to offer people resources, is Brendan Manning's book, The Ragamuffin Gospel and Albus Child. I mean, this man spends his entire writing career trying to make his readers understand his journey of grace and his relationship with God. And the foundation of it is, if God is love, he loves you. And everything he does is out of that expression that he loves you. So to me, you have to believe that God loves you. You have to believe that. If you don't believe that, get some prayer from someone here tonight. Look up those verses where it talks about his love for you. Because everything he does, he stops creation for those he loves. Secondly, it's believing that we serve a God that speaks. Psalm 145:18 says, "The Lord is near to all who call him, to all who call on him in truth." It's a recognition that we do serve a God that does speak. He's not a cosmic energy ball that exists really far away in our sort of stoic society that keeps God at a distance and mankind, you know, living fatalistic at the whim of life. No. We serve a God who is personal. He uses personal terminology, calling us his father. He didn't say your boss. He didn't say your master. Calling us his bride and him as a husband. He didn't say he's that distant older brother that is kind of proud of you, kiddo, but not so much. No, he's a loving husband that cares for his bride. So he listens, he speaks, he responds. The heart that you have to care about the very issue that you're praying for, he is the author of that. And he places those concerns in your heart because he's concerned about them. And it's to draw your attention to those things. We as a people are the very expression of not only God's identity, but are an extension of all his concerns. That's where social justice comes from. He places it in the heart of man. Like, I care about this issue, and I want someone to handle it, and I rule through my people, so I will give a concern into their hearts. And we kind of pray towards something and go, do you even listen? As opposed to like, of course I'm listening. Why do you think you care? Like as if you woke up one morning and invented it, caring about human trafficking. No, I've always been concerned for that. So it's believing that he cares about those things, that he speaks to us. The third one is his word. His word is, again, as I said before, it is Christianity, obviously in written form, it's his written word and his expression of everything we understand of who he is. And I would love to teach a message on where we got our Bible, how it was put together, and some of the sort of concerns people have of like, well, man wrote it, so it must be corrupt, and kind of addressing some of those perspectives. But we understand that his word is a collection of an ancestry that we are a part of by faith, that it is a collection of his interaction with man, both in its purified form when people responded well and had an incredible interaction with God, and those where those things did not go very well. And the opportunity that we have in the time that we live through to read through that and be able to better understand those expressions. Everything we believe and understand today is based on an entire history that we've lived out and learned from. I didn't teach myself algebra. Someone told me that stuff works. I don't understand it. I'm glad there are engineers who do. You know, I believe that stuff works. You know what I mean? Chemotherapy sounds crazy to me. Like, you know, all that stuff. But there are people that go through it and are healed from cancer. I don't understand it, but I get that it works. And the years that people spend in medical school learning this stuff, and for us, it's the same thing. So reading his word allows us to understand what God's stances are and how he speaks and gives us that leg up in our interaction with him. The fourth one is not a very popular one, fasting. Yeah, not a very popular one. Fasting is an opportunity to set aside our most basic need for a time where we begin to focus and celebrate who God is, to seek out where God stands on issues. It is our opportunity to there are a couple books, Shaping History Through Prayer and Fasting is being a popular one by Derek Prince. I think Jettison Franklin wrote a book called The Power of Fasting or something like that. That was a bestseller for a long time. So a lot of these tools come from people who have gone through the fasting experience and have had incredible encounters with God. I think the most I've ever fasted was like 6 days. Yeah. There are people here who have done like weeks. You know what I mean? And they, each of them, I'm sure, can testify to you guys. At the clarity, you begin to hear God's voice. And even, you know, the identity of your flesh and the separation of those two things. And the last and fifth filter is the attribute of who God is. A.W. Tozer wrote the book, The Attributes of God, Knowledge of the Holy, and a couple other books like that, where he begins to talk about the very character of God. Our interaction with one another is based on our understanding of each other's character, right? The question I started at the beginning of this was, why are you a jerk? You automatically believe that about who I am. And your interaction with me will be affected by what you already, your preconceived notions about me. And so we have an opportunity to be introduced to a God who is benevolent, who is good, who does listen, who does love. And if you don't believe those things about him, then your ability to hear him through that is not there. How many of you guys have ever been into an argument with your wife or your girlfriend? For the gentlemen, and I'm sure the ladies as a counterpart. You were too, how often do you have to lean upon the character of the other person during a time that they seem utterly crazy? Like, you're just like looking at this person, you're like, why are we fighting? Like, what is going on right now? But the leaning on each other's character to say, no, she loves me. I'm sure she does not mean that. You know, like, I'm sure right now I'm angry and I'm frustrated and I have to lean on my understanding of her character so that I can get past this right now. Maybe I was being a jerk. You know, I'm sure she's not blind to my actions, you know? Like, it's that recognition that we often, in our approach to God, if we believe that God does not love us, he is distant, he is an angry kid with a magnifying glass, and we're just a bunch of ants he's burning up, then our interaction with him will come from that preconceived notion. Well, you're distant.